So do you have dry skin?
I do. I have to moisturize quite a bit this time of year, despite the fact that we are having a somewhat mild winter. I am waiting for the snow.
Well, it hasn't been wet at all. So do you use a humidifier? That'll alleviate some of the dry skin.
I do.
Actually use a humidifier at night? Now,
I set it on my chest.
With the Vicks VapoRub just blowing in your face.
I think that might have something to do with why I lost my voice last week.
Inhaling Vicks VapoRub.
It's a mix. Well, you can't just... Do you know this? This is a real thing. You can't just do the straight Vicks. Like, if you do that by itself, like, that's too strong. You know that, right?
Really? So you mean putting that on your chest, you can't do that?
No, I mean with the humidifier. So I dilute it with Castrol GTX. Yeah,
that's
I use
good.
A little bit of that.
So you're like one of those Exxon Valdez birds.
I'm exactly like that. Yep.
Someone explained to me that, and I don't know if it was my wife or it was my television wife. Mm. I can't remember. I get them confused sometimes.
Who's your television wife?
The person I spend 4 hours a show with. Uh-huh. On the weekends. Someone was telling me, it was definitely my wife. We were talking about Madonna and why she looks so good during the Super Bowl. And apparently, according to my wife, she Castrol GTX. Every night she envelops her body in some petroleum oil. Mm. And it's like $1,200 a bottle. Mm. It's like $1,200 a bottle to get
She should be
stuff.
A spokeswoman for BP.
Which, by the way, have you seen those new BP commercials where they want to let you know that they're still hanging out? They're still down there.
I did see one of those where it was like, we're still here.
Yeah.
We made a big old mess, but we're still here. I did see that.
She's like, yeah, I'm still here. I grew up here. This is my home. The fish is fantastic now.
they've never been more slippery.
Right. They're just fantastic. They've got a tinge of Castrol GTX in them. They're just fantastic.
Yeah, you know what? Since we just jump all over in the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe, let me jump over to this for a second. I had for a while now, Clayton and I, we go through these phases, right? Musically, I think you heard us talk about this some time in the past. I don't know when. That there are certain artists that we just kind of like fell out with, right? Like Chris Isaak's, that one that we've talked about a few times, right?
Where we loved him. Baja Sessions, fantastic. And then
Baja Sessions was really him at like his zenith, right? Like that was like the best thing ever. And that was 1996, right? That came out. That's a full on 15 plus years ago or whatever now.
Right.
And like then he just kind of became a little boring. And Jack Johnson's another one like that kind of. But then there are other. What I'm trying to say is this is not an example of that. That sometimes there's just an artist that you just stop listening to for whatever reason, right? Maybe it just doesn't come up on your iPod, or you didn't import the albums to begin with, or And a couple years ago, I went through that with Paul Simon, where even though I really like Paul Simon stuff, I went a really long stretch where I wasn't listening to anything by him, and it was just coincidence. It wasn't like a volitional thing. And I guess just recently I must have gone through one of those phases with the Talking Heads. Where you
hadn't listened to in a long time.
Right. Like it just wasn't coming up for whatever reason. It was never on. And I just re-listened to and watched part of the Stop Making Sense concert video that Jonathan Demme made, which was, I think, their last tour. They stopped touring after that because they felt like they could never top it, which is all the way back in 1984. You know, on those latter albums of theirs, they never toured in support of Little Creatures, True Stories, or Naked. There were no tours associated with those albums. It wasn't until Byrne went solo that he hit the road again.
It's funny because you and I used to watch that concert tape quite a bit.
Oh, my God, yeah. In the days of VHS tapes and VCRs, like, we... Neither of us owned it, but we would rent and re-rent it from the local video store, the local Hollywood Video or whatever the heck it was, West Coast Video maybe.
Right.
Like, until the tape had been stretched.
Right.
And, like, it lost video quality. In just re-watching some of that, that is such a landmark performance, not just for the Talking Heads, but, like, all around. And what really kind of gave me some perspective on it was my very, very favorite Talking Heads song is This Must Be the Place, Naive Melody, which is done to terrific visual effect in the film, especially during the solo where David Byrne, I think he's in the big suit as he's doing it, he dances with that lamp.
Right. Which was in the dark. The dark, you know, they shut all the lights off on the stage pretty much, right?
Right. There's some background projections of buildings, which, you know, is like a recurring theme through so many of the Talking Head songs, buildings. It's even in the title of one of their albums, more songs about buildings and food. But apart from this, you know, back projection of a cityscape behind him, you know, it's just him in a darkened theater having this sort of like, I don't know how to describe it. Like, there's like a romance to the way he dances with this lamp. And it's so bizarre, and it's really, it's very hypnotic. But then I stumbled across, there is a Talking Heads tribute band called This Must Be the Band.
I've heard of them. I've heard of them upon an iTunes search.
Ah.
Are they any good? Have you listened to them?
Well, I happened to find then a clip of them recreating that exact thing from Stop Making Sense at one of their shows.
Video.
And it was done, you know, obviously, like it was a loving homage to, you know, that really remarkable 6-minute slice of that concert film. And it just kind of like, yeah, it just sort of dawned on me like, wow, like this has really been like absent from my musical diet lately. You know, the weirdness of them. And one of the things about that I really like is, and I think, you know, this is not just true of the Talking Heads. This is true of so many artists, like of the groups that you and I love, like They Might Be Giants and REM and so on and so forth, where the lyrics are so open to interpretation that you can kind of impose your own meaning on them, and the lyrics are durable enough to withstand that. Right. And I thought what was really interesting was that I read a piece about, it was just by a blogger who said that, in their opinion, the Talking Heads song Once in a Lifetime is about the midlife crisis. And they went on to explain in really eloquent detail how they got that, like how these lyrics, which don't, to me, imply that, this blogger inferred it from the lyrics. And I thought that was really fascinating. And it just kind of, you know, it called to mind some of the songs like that, I think. You know, obviously, all of these bands, they have songs which are less subject to that type of interpretation, right? Like, right. If you listen to the song James K. Polk by They Might Be Giants, it's pretty straightforward what they're talking about. Or, you know, if you can follow along, like, the allusions that R.E.M. draws in Man on the Moon, you have a real understanding of what it is that they're talking about. But in that same way, of course, you know, they also have songs which are more subjective. You know, Nothing But Flowers is a great example from the Talking Heads, which is a song we talked about exhaustively some time ago here on The Grizz. I don't even remember when. You know, about this idea of a guy in a more natural future where some of the industrialization has been stripped out of the world, and then he has like a longing for it. Like, he misses the shopping malls and he misses the fast food joints and things like that. And, you know, those I think are a little more rigid, but it just kind of called to mind to me that there are some of those really great ones. And Once in a Lifetime is such a perfect example of that, where it really is subject to your interpretation.
Sure. And I think that's sort of like, I think I might have mentioned this with you before, but, you know, Michael Stipe saying that about some of his, about his songs, sure. Right? That once they're out there, unless they're obvious, like, right, Everybody Hurts, you know, when someone asks.
But even that has a level of subjectivity to it. That's a good example, but, you know, that's another one that you sort of, you know, you mold it to your own experience.
Right, and certainly that's what was so appealing to me about R.E.M. and R.E.M.'s and Michael Stipe's lyrics is that they're malleable in that way to sort of fit, you know, maybe that your place in life or where you are at that time. You know, for me, Once in a Lifetime, I mean, I would agree with that assessment that it is, you know, at least loosely based on the idea of a midlife crisis, you know, that, mm-hmm. you know, letting the days go by. And, but I mean, I guess you could see how it would be something else entirely. I mean, you know, I think about so other R.E.M. songs like World Leader, Pretend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, half the songs on Monster are open to that sort of level of interpretation. And it is funny, and you know, when you're younger and you're just listening to it, or you're just enjoying it because you just enjoy the music behind it, you're not even really paying attention to the lyrics. Maybe when you're a little kid,
mm-hmm.
and then as you get older and you're actually starting to pay more attention to the lyrics, you're like, oh, that song's completely different than what I thought it was as a kid. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, especially those groups in particular, which are three of our very favorites, the Talking Heads, and They Might Be Giants and R.E.M. Not in all of their songs, but there are definitely examples of this. And maybe to contrast it against some other groups where, you know, everything tends to be a little more literal. Maybe because recently, like, I've really spent a lot of time listening to Mayor Hawthorne, where his stuff is very direct. You know, he's talking about a very specific, you know, when he's singing about a breakup, like, it's very clear what he's singing about, right. You know? Like, there's no hiding behind clever imagery or things like that. But one of the great things, and this goes all the way back to, you know, I don't know whether it was the Beatles that really ushered this in during some of their more experimental days or whatever, but I really like the tendency at times for the lyrics to come sort of stream of consciousness. Like, I think about Don't Let's Start by They Might Be Giants, where... you really aren't at times even getting fully formed thoughts. You're getting like glimpses into something. And it's kind of up to you to assemble these individual glimpses into a greater whole that's relevant to your experience. You know, another one along those same lines, which is great. And I think maybe this has a special place in my heart because you and I once fumbled our ways through it, is Anna Ang.
Right.
You know, where it's really like these sort of non sequitur, like, you know, removed from any greater context kind of... you know, glimpses into what's going on with them. And what makes that song so much fun, too, is if you've ever seen the video for Anna Ang, which is one of my very favorite They Might Be Giants videos, like, it really does nothing to help your comprehension of the song whatsoever. They're not attempting to give you any further elaboration.
No, in fact, I watched a They Might Be Giants stage video the other night from a performance just a few days ago, actually. And they had some sort of interlude video that pops up with these avatars. Or they're called.
This is their new project. That one, the thing with the avatars is their new project. I don't know if it's out there yet, but
so they put up like these hand puppet things, right? I mean, they're up there,
yes.
And they're basically talking about their new show. You know, but they might be giants, very much like that. You're like, what does that even mean? Like a boat of car? Like what do these songs even mean? Or what are these little snippets? And I think you're right about that. I mean, the Beatles, like, if you try to figure out like what some of their songs are about, especially if you're listening to songs off of like Abbey Road, or even some of Sgt. Pepper's stuff coming together, like
even go back to like Tomorrow Never Knows and songs like that, which precede it, which are really stream of consciousness. You know, it's like drifting through someone else's dream, listening to these songs. Like, you know, maybe because previous to the arrival of them, my knowledge of music is scarce at best. Like, I'll tell you a little something here about Buddy Holly or a little something here about Elvis Presley, but you know, like, to me, that's kind of where it came from, and they really like opened the door for artists to be able to do that.
Right. I mean, then some things, of course, are jumping off points, like You Never Give Me Your Money was Paul McCartney, you know, taking on his feelings towards Alan Klein, about, you know, empty promises to him throughout the years. But then, it's, you know, then some of the lyrics have nothing to do with that, if you're listening to the song. And it's certainly going to, like, the melody, you know, the Polythene Pam, which was, like, contributed by Lennon. You know, Lennon wrote that, so that was stuck in there. And it's like, you're just like, where am I going? And you even get some of those. Like, I feel like you're on, like, this little raft, sort of, like, floating down a river. And,
yeah. Well, specifically the songs that Clayton's alluding to that are that giant medley B-side of Abbey Road, especially that, like, not just lyrically, but musically, right? It all just blends together so beautifully. It's like this perfect hunk of music.
Yeah. It's funny, though. You brought up an interesting thing about going through. I mean, now that I switched on iTunes Match a few months ago, you know, because there were albums that I just never had with me.
Oh, I thought that was an online dating service. Go ahead.
Right. I gave up on eHarmony, and I decided to start going with iTunes Match.
Mm-hmm. Right on.
I find the chicks are a little more accessible on iTunes Match.
I see.
And what's great about the girls on iTunes Match is they sync in the cloud, which is great.
That's sexy.
So you have her wherever you need her, which is great.
I like that.
But since I flipped that switch, you know, there were albums I just never had on my device because it wouldn't fit, you know. So I would sort of pick and choose, and I'd go through and say, yeah, I want all the Beatles records, I want these R.E.M. records, I want these Sting albums on here, whatever, and that would be on my iPhone, and I would listen to those, you know, in the car or whatever, do shuffle mode and throw different songs on. But now with iTunes Match, you know, I have everything now that I own suddenly again, and their albums, like, I'll just do a random shuffle, and I'm like, God, I haven't heard this album in such a long time, and I'll just go on a tear. I mean, recently I went on a bit of a They Might Be Giants tear again. You know, it had been a while since I really listened to everything, of course. And when you and I went through every album again, that was when I started doing that. I thought, God, I missed so much of this good stuff.
Yeah.
And there were a few other things. In fact, Mike Nesmith, I'd spent quite a bit of time recently going through and re-listening those, some of those albums, I had like, and the hits just keep on coming on my phone, you know, that record. But some of the other stuff from like the First National Band days, I didn't have just readily available. I just didn't have like Nevada Fighter and those albums, or even Tantamount to Treason, like handy and ready to go. Now they're all there. And I just hit shuffle and I was listening through, you know, some of those recently and continuing to re-listen to that stuff. So it's been, it's funny when I'm going back, like Paul Young, listening to like some Paul Young stuff again. Some random stuff in my 80s archive.
Yeah. Yeah, I recently, I think it was brought on when I got that amazing Zigzag concert. It kind of got me to go back and revisit some of the Nesmith stuff because, you just kind of, stuff rotates out of your diet, you know? And I'm definitely one of those guys that when I have the shuffle mode on my iPod, like I just kind of gravitate toward like the same maybe 100 or so songs. Like I just skip ahead like till I find one of my favorites. And, you know, I'm listening to like Don't Shed a Tear by Paul Carrack for the 200th time. Like I just skip around too much. And then I kind of got into this mode where I really wanted to hear albums the way they were. I definitely went through that with Magnetic South, which is the first Nesmith solo record with the First National Band after he was freed from the Monkees. And, you know, I used to only have that as part of that. Do you remember that double set called Complete?
Right. Yeah. That double disc set. But it wasn't three discs in there?
Well, it was the three discs compiled onto two.
That's right.
So you had that whole First National Band trilogy, and like that was almost too much music to ingest as one, you know, like 31 songs or whatever that ends up being. Like it was too much. But just Magnetic South by itself, those exact 10 songs, like that really gave me like an appreciation for that I never had as when it was part of that collection. I don't know if you remember this, but I actually opened the box for that in your bedroom the day I got that. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember.
It was like a hot summer afternoon. I'd ordered it, like it was shipped, I think, from England. And it came to me in the mail, of course. And I opened that and had it in your room. That's where I first had it. And it had a book, a little booklet. And then it also came with like an order form. And I thought this was really clever. It stayed with me even now. There was a picture of Nez on the order form. And on the back, it, you know, had like a little checklist of all the different things that were available by him, you know, his albums, his book, or, you know, whatever else, movies that he'd produced, things like that, like a coffee mug with his face on it. And then there was the last box was all of the above. And then on the order form, it said, just send me everything Michael Nesmith has ever done. Don't care what it is. Don't care what it costs and the price. And that stayed with me.
Yeah, it'd be nice to be able to do that today. You know, like some Boz Scaggs I was listening to recently, dug that out and some.
Hey, where's a good place to start with Boz Scaggs? Like, I mean, other than like an obvious, like a greatest hits or something like that.
You know, I that's funny you say that because I only have about 10 tracks of his and they're sort of scattered tracks that I just sort of purchased randomly. I have his hits album where he's in that ridiculous black and white sort of checkered jacket. And you know, I think he's from the Bay Area, so my wife has seen him, I think, in concert a couple of times. You know, he opened for
Steely Dan.
Yeah, Steely Dan. When I saw Steely Dan in Philly, and you know, he's great. Mm-hmm. You know, song Lowdown, Lido Shuffle. There's some great stuff in there. I think his album Silk Degrees is probably a good place to start because that has Lowdown on it. It has some other good stuff on there. I do have that album. So, do you have any of his stuff?
No, I don't. But I'm sure it would be right up my alley, so.
Yeah. Yeah, that and some Al Stewart I was listening to.
That's so funny. I was just about to mention him.
Really?
Yeah, I was just about to bring up Al Stewart because I have a couple, like, hits compilations of his and a concert disc of his, but I have none of the individual albums. And the one, I don't know, maybe it's the same one that you originally had, that one where it's kind of like a brownish cover with blue text of him just like sitting on a desk with a globe next to him.
Globe, yeah. That, I was going to say, is it a clock next to him? No.
Yeah, that best of, the one that, the first track is Time Passages and the last track is Year of the Cat. And it has that live version of On the Border with Peter White on guitar. I really love that collection. And then I got another collection of his, which had some of the same tracks, but some were different. Like, it had a song of his I'd never heard before called Night Train to Munich, which I really, really liked. But I don't have any of his individual albums. But yeah, it's funny because that was like the next thing coming out of my mouth was going to be about Al Stewart. Like, that's a guy, like, I would like to know a good jumping on point for his albums, because everything I've heard by him I've enjoyed.
Yeah, me too. And actually, the reason I kind of got into that again is because I was listening to something on, I think it was Sirius. No, you know what it was? It was on Pandora, music streaming service. And we were having dinner, and I had it on, I don't know if it was a Billy Joel station on Pandora, which, by the way, you know how there are certain stations you create on Pandora which are good. Maybe you have to skip a track here and there. But when you choose, like, hey, create a station around your favorite, you know, whatever artist you want to do, and it'll find similarly sounding songs to play around this particular, and then maybe every fifth or sixth song, it'll be the artist you chose, you know, like Billy Joel. So, like, every sixth song is a Billy Joel song. So I created a Billy Joel station, streaming it over on my Sonos, you know, during dinner time in the kitchen there, and put that on. It's probably most of the songs we'll know, be able to sing along to at dinner, have an enjoyable meal, whatever. So I got Billy Joel playing, and like every song on that station is fantastic. Because, you know, you're going to go from there, like Elton John. But then there's like a lot of Al Stewart stuff. And then some live Al Stewart stuff that I hadn't heard, like a really cool live version of Year of the Cat they were playing. And it just makes me, you know, I end up learning or reminding myself of the great songs that I love, just that I don't have to pick. It's like someone else doing it for me. So that Billy Joel station kind of got me into going back and listening to some stuff again, and Al Stewart specifically. Also, I think you guys were talking about this on the Trending Show, but Dave Matthews Band. That's one of those where I was listening to the Live at Luther College album.
That's such a good one. Him and Tim Reynolds.
Yeah, I had forgotten how much I liked that album. Boy, there was, what is it?
There's a lot of songs on there, too. That was like, that's like, what, 28 tracks or something like that?
Yeah, and, you know, it's two disc set, I think, you know, but it's got that great live version of One Sweet World. And,
yes.
What else is great on that?
Like, he does everything from the repertoire at that time, right? Because that was right after, it covers all the material up to and including Crash.
Right.
Which to me was like, that was kind of like the end of the master run for Dave Matthews. So, you know, this like dueling guitar acoustic set that he did with Tim Reynolds, made up of all material from those three albums, is like, that's the perfect Dave Matthews live set for me.
Yeah, 41, Tripping Billy's, Jimmy Thing, all that good stuff on there. So I was playing that the other night, and I forgot how much I liked that album. And then, of course, they've had so many live albums, and the reason I brought it up, or you guys were talking about it on the Trending Show, is because there's a new Dave Matthews album coming out very soon. Did you get their latest one, the Big Whiskey?
Yes. I did get that, and it's okay.
Yeah, you know, that's how I feel about it. It's okay.
Yeah, but, you know, they did go through that kind of dark period where I think what was going on was they were changing producers, and they had one or two producers back to back that I don't think really understood the band's sound. Like that album Every Day is one of them.
Yeah,
that, like, until they got to Busted Stuff, which really was, you know, that was like a collection of outtakes and stuff they never finished from before, kind of slapped together. But you could hear the old Dave Matthews Band coming back out of that, because they did. They had that Before These Crowded Streets is one of those where it has like one or two songs that I really like, and the rest is a throwaway. And Every Day, and I think there's one other in there that I'm overlooking. But
Gray Street is one of my favorites off Busted Stuff.
Yes, I agree. I think that's the highlight of that whole album.
Yeah, me too.
And then they started to, you know, kind of rebound a little bit, and they definitely went through that period where it was like every summer they would release some monstrous live concert thing. You know, because they are, you know, up there with like the Grateful Dead and Fish and those other like nonstop touring jam bands that would get bootlegged, like, you know, notoriously their concerts would get bootlegged because there was such a voracious appetite from their audience for their live performances. But I think they almost overdid it, you know, like there's got to be at least what, 8 or 9 double or triple disc concert sets from Dave Matthews Band.
Like, I'm thinking of that. I think I have two. Well,
I have four of them, and I know I don't even have them all. I have Live at Red Rocks. I have Live in Chicago. I have the Central Park one. I have that Luther College one.
Yeah, I don't have. Yeah, I have Live at Chicago, Luther College, and Live at Red Rocks. Live at Red Rocks is great. I have to dig that out. I don't have that in my iTunes files. I need to find that again. Ooh, that's a good one.
Speaking of ones that have fallen out of my musical diet recently to return, have you ever heard the Moody Blues live at Red Rocks?
No. No, I haven't.
They turn in a monstrous... One of my favorite Moody Blues songs is Question.
Yeah.
they turn in like this. It is the most bombastic, over the top. I mean, that song's kind of over the top to begin with, but yeah, it's man, that's really good. And that wow, is that the Moody Blues past their prime? But they still nailed it.
Beach Boys coming back. Did you happen to see any of the Grammys the other night?
No, I am aware that they took place, but that's about it.
Yeah, and I don't usually watch the Grammys, certainly anymore. I don't need to see Jay-Z perform.
Right, well, mine's in a nursing home, that's why.
And so, because of the Whitney Houston stuff, you know, just was out of curiosity. I definitely wanted to see, like, Jennifer Hudson turn in her sort of tribute performance, which was fantastic. But the Beach Boys came out, and they've prided themselves lately, at least, the Grammys, on doing these sort of reunion events.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the Police came back and did their reunion event at the Grammys a few years ago. There were a couple of others that got together. And so they had the Beach Boys come on. They sounded great. I mean, they sounded really fantastic. And now apparently they're going on tour again.
Yes, for the 50th anniversary year for the Beach Boys. And Brian Wilson is with them.
Yeah, I mean, and he sounded great. I mean, it just, you know, I don't know, looked a little off, though.
Right. Do you remember, you know, a couple of years ago, he released a solo album that did really well called Smile.
Hmm.
And he toured in support of, you know, and he's, well, he went through a phase where he was a notorious hermit. Of course, the world didn't see him for quite a while. The reviews were saying, like, they couldn't believe how incredible the concert was, given the fact that he is kind of up there in years.
Yeah.
Brian Wilson is. And, you know, I felt that same way. I was really fortunate. This is quite a little while ago now, because I guess, if I'm thinking about it right, well, Tito Puente passed away, what, like in the year 2000?
It's been a few years, yeah.
Yeah, I got to see him the year before he passed away in Reading, our hometown of Reading. He was playing at the then Raya Theater, which is now the Sovereign Performing Arts Center there. And was easily 75 years old at this point, if not older. And he was just a ball of energy like I've never seen. And there were no breaks. He just went. And he was just a sight to behold. Like he was just all over the place. Like he was dancing up a storm, and he had the whole theater dancing. It was incredible just to kind of see like the level of energy that he exuded at that age.
Speaking of that, at that age, Tony Bennett was out there performing at the Grammys too.
Hmm.
You know, still has an incredible voice, but you could see like he was out there promoting or singing a song off of his new Duets album.
Mm-hmm.
Duets 2, I guess, which is his first number one album I think it may be his first number one album ever.
Hmm.
If I'm not, that's how they introduced it anyway. And on stage, he came out along with, was it Taylor Swift, I think?
Hmm.
Either that or Kelly Pickler. I don't know, one of those like American Idol style blondes who I can't keep track of.
Hmm.
And they sang a duet together. But he, like, lost. He forgot some of the lyrics.
Mm.
I feel like he's up there, man. He's up there.
Yeah.
There was, though, a new album I just got. Did you see the new Paul McCartney?
I have seen it floating around, but I haven't heard it.
Yeah, it's at Starbucks. I saw it the other day, and it reminded me, because on the Apple TV, this is the first time they've ever done this, a live performance. And Apple was promoting it where you could watch it, like, streaming, I think even on, maybe even through iTunes, I don't even know, but it was on, like, the Apple TV. They had, like, a little special button that popped up, like, last week, where you could click on it and watch it live, like, 7 p.m. Pacific time or something like that. So it was streaming, and it was a full concert available for free to watch, and it was live. And I think you're seeing this trend, right, because Netflix is starting to produce their own content, like, streaming content. A couple of shows they're getting involved with, I think, some other online stuff they're doing as well, where you can. The Wall Street Journal the other day had a whole breakdown of all these like production companies that are producing like online only content now. Mm-hmm. So Paul McCartney did this live version of this album, and I guess that's going to be available to download. This album, Kisses on the Bottom. So I was at Starbucks. I'm like, oh, a new McCartney record. I'll probably, you know, I might as well pick it up. I'm always a big fan of Paul, and so I bought it while I was standing in line at Starbucks. And started listening to it. And actually, Diana Krall is on there. And it's a bunch of old standards, I guess. I didn't realize. And I guess he's only singing two new songs. Mm. But it's a lot of, like, old standards and stuff. But Diana Krall, and there's some other songs. And it was pretty, it's really good. I mean, I had it on the background while I was doing some work in my office the other day, and pretty peaceful. I mean, it's very bare bones. Like, it's not like a fully produced sort of typical Paul McCartney pop album at all. It's very, sort of very somber. Hmm. And I guess it's, I guess it's romantic. I don't know. What do I
He's
know?
Mellowing with age.
Yeah.
As all the elder statesmen of rock and pop have, the Nick Lowe's, and, you know, Leonard Cohen has a new album out, by the way, speaking of the elder statesmen. And, I don't have a taste for that. I think something about Leonard Cohen is just outside my grasp.
Yeah, yeah, it's not something I'd be purchasing anytime soon.
Well, I think this is an opportune time for us to pause, and I want to tell you about one of the terrific show sponsors we have here at the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe, to whom we are indebted for their longtime support of all the things that we do. I'm talking about our friends Cobra Electronics. You can find them online at cobra.com, and we'd appreciate it if you would drop by their website and show them some love, since it is only through their support that programs like these are able to exist. Now, if you're wondering what you might find over there, I'll tell you. They're the industry leaders when it comes to all types of navigation stuff, including their revolutionary and award-winning system, the Cobra iRadar system. This is for state-of-the-art, up-to-date, real-time red light, laser, and radar detection is the other one. I almost forgot there. That's powered by the ARA driving hazard database, which is verified and re-verified twice a day to make sure you are getting the most up-to-date driving safety information. And I know this from my own personal experience, which is why I love the Cobra iRadar system. It simply makes you a safer and more alert driver. You are so aware of all your surroundings at all times because it's continuously giving you updates everywhere that you go. You find, you know, whether you're traveling by yourself and you just need somebody to keep you awake in the wee hours, or you're traveling with your family and you want to make sure that you're safe out there on the road, the Cobra iRadar system, which pairs through Bluetooth technology with your smartphone and has a completely customizable dashboard so you get only the types of alerts that you want, is the way to go. They're also the makers of the Cobra Tag system, which is a two-way locator that works between a key fob you attach to your keychain and a free app that you put on your smartphone so that if you were to ever misplace your phone, you can locate it using the key fob and vice versa. Those are just two of the many incredible things that you'll find over at Cobra.com, which also include GPS navigators, CB radios, and all manner of other terrific electronics. Go and see our friends at Cobra.com.
Wait, what do you know about Ultimate Fighting?
I know some stuff about Ultimate Fighting. What would you like to know about Ultimate Fighting?
Well, the other night, my wife and I are watching TV, and this commercial comes on for this new reality show where all these Ultimate Fighters are going to live together in a house. Have you seen this thing?
I've not seen this particular ad.
They're all like going to live together, and there's some sort of announcer guy sitting on a staircase, and he's like, you know, these guys get pumped up, and the fact that they're going to be competing like this, living together 24 hours a day, training together, having to fight each other in these matches, and knowing that they're going to be watched by millions of people, that is going to just fire them up. And this is one of the greatest competitions ever. You know, these guys fight their hearts out, and now that they know they're going to be competing and be watched by millions of people, and I don't even know what channel it's on. It might be like on NBC or something at night. But it's like going to be a new primetime like reality show for Ultimate Fighting. And I looked at my wife, and I'm like, I wonder what the shelf life is for these guys, right? I mean, I know like boxing, you know, they're like actual professional boxing right now. I mean, we know why like Muhammad Ali has the disease that he has, right? Being hit in the head so many times, right? But I got to think you're getting kneed in the head, kicked, thrown into against a cage. Sure. Like, what is the shelf life for these guys? I mean, you have to know these guys, right?
I would say it's you know, in terms of, to use some sports terminology, God help me, like in terms of their prime earning years, like when they can really be marquee level fighters, I would say at the very maximum it seems that, you know, 2 to 3 years for the vast majority. And that's not to say there aren't a couple exceptions that manage to milk it for a few more years than that, you know, maybe just based on their name value. But It's massive, massive business. You know, they go all over the world. Their pay-per-views gross millions and millions of dollars. Every live event gate of theirs grosses millions and millions of dollars. And, you know, it wasn't all that many years ago when the Ultimate Fighting Championship, which is sort of that premier mixed martial arts commonly called MMA, mixed martial arts type competition. They're the premier brand in that right now. You know, in the same way that you might think of the WWE as being the premier brand in professional wrestling, UFC is very much that in the world of mixed martial arts. They were almost bankrupt. They almost went out of business. You know, they were bought out and sort of reinvented. And a lot of their current success is really attributable to who is the guy who's very often compared in the MMA world to Vince McMahon from professional wrestling, a guy named Dana White. Is a he's a very charismatic, he's a very intelligent promoter. At times has been people have tried to deride him by saying that he's ruthless. But you know,
it's a fantastic social media guy too.
Yes, he gets that in a way that a lot of people do not. And I'd like to say this: I don't know Dana White for that matter. I don't know Vince McMahon either. I've never met either of these gentlemen personally. But it's always funny to me, you know, when you come across individuals that are as driven as those types of men must be to reach the level that they do. And, you know, Steve Jobs is another guy like that, where the people who really don't understand the level of dedication to your particular craft or your particular niche that you must have to succeed in those types of, you know, like earth-shaking ways, there will always be the people that cannot understand that, cannot understand the sacrifices and the choices that you have to make to get there. And then you end up with people who, you know, they want to deride, whether it's, you know, Steve Jobs or whether it's Dana White or people like that, because they cannot relate to their drive and their ambition. And but nevertheless, yeah. I mean, how I got off on that tangent, I'll never know. But to answer your question,
even a Mark Cuban, you know.
Yes, that's another good example. You know, because of even the high-level sparring takes such a toll on these guys that they really don't have, you know, the kind of longevity that you might see from players in other sports, because they take so much abuse doing what they do. You know, it can be quite brutal. And, you know, a lot of the states where the athletic commissions or countries where they've tried to ban MMA or things like that, like, that's always the big counter argument. They just say it's unadulterated brutality.
Yeah, I don't know. I just was wondering, man, how long can these guys last? I mean, just taking the beatings that they do. And so much so to go through a whole reality show, Top Chef style, where you're having these matches on a regular basis and you're hoping to see who can get to the end of this thing. Mm-hmm. Seemed crazy to me. But that's not where I apply my trade. I apply my trade in lighter things. Have you seen this?
In lighter
like Disney. I saw this book while I was on vacation last week, and I thought this would be right up our alley. I was just doing a little shopping in the Kindle store, and I hit the little travel book section. I was like, I'll just dip around here, see what's in here lately. I haven't been in there in a long time. And right at the top of the list was this really interesting-looking book on Disney called, like, The Hidden Side of Disney, or Disney's Dark Side.
Yes.
Have you heard of this book?
I do know what you're talking about.
Have you read it?
I don't think so, but I've read a similar work, and when I got it, actually, I think that the book you're talking about was, like, recommended.
Right, and it has, like, a picture of a half-naked woman on the front, and she's, like, covered in tattoos wearing Mickey ears.
That must be the other book. The one I have, which I think is called Behind the Mouse Ears or something like that, just has, like, a sort of, we're trying not exactly to show Mickey Mouse here so we don't get our pants sued off. Mm-hmm. And I think even in the preface, the author described the number of ways the Disney Corporation attempted to block the publication of his book.
Wow. This one is called The Dark Side of Disney. It just came out last year. It reveals all the tips, tricks, scams, and stories they don't want you to know about. Unabashedly afraid of offending the family-oriented audiences catered to Disney or other travel guides. This guy is by Leonard Kinsey, and apparently there's all sorts of tales, you know, from off-limit areas, which I'm fascinated by. If I want to read it, if only for that section, you know, learning about, of course, the underground things and stuff that, you know, you get to see beneath, like, the Haunted Mansion, all that sort of fun stuff. The stuff with, like, the travel stuff with the travel guides, the chronicles of drug-induced debauchery. Mm-hmm. It talked about, like, I guess, and maybe even back in the 60s or whatever, when, you know, just in these underground areas where the cast members would go. And apparently they say it'll actually make your next trip there more enjoyable because you'll be looking for these places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the book that I read, it was a little out of date. You know, like there, it seemed like most of the stories were actually from the era right after the parks had opened. You know, they were really like dated stories, but you know, crazy things. You know, like, oh, you know, someone was beheaded on Space Mountain, and this is how they covered it up and kept it out of the news and things like that. And you know, there were all those types of stories.
Yeah. This guy, he actually, the author, went there over 100 times by the time he was 18 years old. And he's obsessed with it. So he comes from a place of really, really loving the place. Not, you know, he's not like out with an axe to grind, which I think is fascinating. So I'm going to start working on that and read that and report back soon.
And you found that in the Kindle store, you said?
Yeah, I think you can get it on Kindle pretty darn easily. It's $10. I got it on Kindle, and there's it's $2 on Kindle. It's $11 if you want to buy the paperback. Yeah, so I'll send you the link if you're interested, and I'll tweet it out on the Grizz account too if anyone else is interested in picking up The Dark Side of Disney. I know we have some other Disney fans who love that stuff. So,
well, I recently got a gift from my friend Clayton Morris. He sent me a movie called Breach.
Oh, yeah, you did get that. I forgot I sent that to you. Did you get a chance to watch it yet? Had you ever seen that, by the way? Because it's not available. You can't, like, it's hard to find. That's why I sent it to you.
No.
Because you can't find it on Netflix. You can't get, I don't know, it's really, you can't get the DVD. It's, I don't know why. It's just hard to find.
No, I've never seen it, at least as far as I know. And I kind of wanted to talk to you about it because I'm sure there must have been a reason that you sent it to me. It didn't just randomly appear here. So what motivated you to send me this film?
Well, it's one of my favorites. I love it. First of all, it's about the spy, Robert Hansen, the most famous spy in U.S. history, the most notorious. You know, everyone knows, I guess, the other stories of the, what are the other spies?
There's the spy versus spy.
Right, from
I'm
Mad
familiar
Magazine.
With those two guys, the one in the white and the one in the black.
I think of, what is the... A famous, I was trying to think of his name. They actually reference him in the movie quite a bit.
Nick Fury.
Keep going. Moon Knight.
No, he's not. No, he's a vigilante. It's different.
Let's see. No. Well, Robert Hansen, anyway, is one of the he was a former American FBI agent who began his career working as a Soviet spy. So he was spying on the Russians, but then got in cahoots with them and began selling classified information from the U.S. to the Soviets. One of my it's played. I don't know if you've never seen the film. Chris Carter. I hope I'm saying the right name.
The guy who came up with the X-Files.
Now what am I trying to say here? Chris Cooper. I knew I got it wrong. Chris Cooper is one of my favorite actors. He is remarkable. Of course, you know him from the Bourne films, right? He was in the first Bourne film as the guy who sort of...
He's always kind of in that same role, though. Like, that's a guy who's like, he's always kind of like, I'm that bureaucrat at the FBI that's out to get you.
If you see him in this, though, you'll say, wow, all right, now this guy, he's got range. And if you ever see him in the movie adaptation, that Nick Cage movie.
I know what you're talking about, but I haven't seen the film.
That he won an Academy Award for that role. He's unrecognizable. He's missing like his four front teeth, and he's fantastic. In fact, I want to go back and rewatch that film. Anyway, we were watching it the other night. I told my wife about it. He was a devout Catholic. He was also a member of Opus Dei, Robert Hansen was. He was a little nutty, the character played by Ryan Phillippe, who plays Eric O'Neill in the film. And Eric O'Neill was the FBI agent who they just sort of brought in blindly. Like, they didn't know he didn't know why he was suddenly being asked to sort of watch him. They just told him that he was a sexual deviant.
Maybe I have seen this. This all sounds very familiar.
And he starts working with him in his office, and he's sort of watching him, and he's like, this guy's clean as a whistle. He goes to church, and he's like, why are you having me watching it, this guy? You know, and he starts to, then they kind of bring him in on the story. They wise him up to why he's actually been brought in to watch him. But then it just gets incredibly tense, and it's so well done. I mean, it all made all the more interesting by the fact that it's real. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's a real film. And Eric O'Neill wrote the book. He then later left the FBI after this whole ordeal because he just felt like, this isn't for me. Mm-hmm. And he wrote the book on it, and which turned into the screenplay and later the movie. But anyway, it's a fantastic film. I love it. It's right in that thriller. So last night we actually went to try to go see Safe House. Have you heard about this film?
No.
It's the new Denzel Washington film. It's supposed to be...
Oh, I've seen some commercials for it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Everyone on Twitter was saying, I said, hey, we're going to go see this. Please, I hope it's as good as... Because mother-in-law's in town. I hope it's as good as... if we're going to use a movie night, I hope it's good. And everyone said it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's gotten great reviews. And it's supposed to be... Everyone's saying it's sort of like the next Bourne style film. Really good. So
you couldn't talk your wife into Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance is what you're saying.
Right. So when you do a little like Fandango search, right, to find out what films, like this one's tops at the box office. Safe House was number one, and like all the sort of Rotten Tomatoes ratings said go. You know, it was like in quotes, go see it, must see. And then Ghost Rider is like fourth or fifth down on the list, and it's like, it says so-so.
Hmm. Well, that's way better than the first one.
Right, I know, apparently. And so we went over to see Safe House. We forgot that it was President's Day holiday. Hmm. And the two showings were at 7:30 and 7:45, and both were sold out when we got there.
Hmm.
Like, ah, damn, we should have bought it tickets before we left the house, you know. And got there, sold out, so we didn't get a chance to see it. So, but you haven't seen Ghost Rider yet, have you?
No, nor do I know that I will, I think. If I'm going to leverage it right, probably the next movie I'm going to see in the theaters will come around May 4th when The Avengers finally hits.
Have you heard anything about Ghost Rider? Is it getting a better...
No. I mean, I've heard zero word of mouth. So that probably says a little bit about how it's doing at the box office.
I'm going to jump over here around Tomatoes and see what's going on with it. I'm curious if it's any better. Ghost Rider. Ooh. Oh, man. It did get $22 million this weekend.
Mm.
It has a 15% right now on Rotten Tomatoes. Although I can't say that Safe House is doing much better. It's at 53% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Mm.
Chronicle, though, is pretty high up there.
Mm-hmm.
We were going to try to just see some of these Academy Award films that have been nominated because we haven't seen any of them. The only one I think we saw was Moneyball. So we haven't seen... We haven't really seen any of them. We wanted to see Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. That's the next one. I think we both want to see that.
Hmm.
But yeah, Ghost Rider came in third at the box office this weekend, for money at least raised.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly no lack of appetite for schlocky films in the world, nor is there from movie production houses to repeat on money-making ideas of the past, which is most likely why Michael Bay will be returning for a fourth Transformers movie, as unthinkable as this is to anyone that has ever liked a robot.
Oh, God.
They are bringing Michael Bay back. He is doing a fourth Transformers film, and, he's really just taken this concept from the shared childhood of people in our generation and raped and massacred it over and over again. And made some really horrendously bad films in the process. and they're just keep making some more money for us, Michael Bay.
God.
It was, Dark Side of the Moon was one of the top grossing films from last year, that third Transformers movie.
Yeah, that blew me away. I was glad, though, that I think Harry Potter beat it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was glad that I think... No, yeah, no. Did it come in? You said third, right? It came in third.
I don't remember, but it was astonishing. It beat out all the superhero films.
Hmm. Yeah, I still can't believe it, and it doesn't really matter, right? It doesn't matter that the movie's bad because so many people are going to see it, and the kids are buying the toys. And here's something interesting: the other day,
ugly toys too. God,
right. You know, my mom this past few weeks she came and visited, and every time she comes, she wants to unload some of my old toys out of the attic.
Hmm.
Which part of me doesn't mind, and part of me does because
yes,
I want to like kind of keep them there because I'm not ready to go through them yet.
Right.
But so she brought two boxes of toys, and my son immediately started diving in and started playing with my kit from Knight Rider car with the David Hasselhoff figurine.
Mm.
and some other things in there. My Centurion dolls.
Centurions Power Extreme.
Yep, some Centurions.
Which one did you have? You had, this was one I didn't have. I had the guy that, I had Ace McCloud. I'll tell you, I know his name. The guy that flew, Ace McCloud. And then I had the guy that was like the ground guy, the guy that had like a tank.
Right.
Whose name I don't remember. And I didn't have the underwater guy.
Oh, I had him.
It was Max something, right? He had a mustache.
Yes, yes, yes. And
like Max Aquatic. Like they all had these really...
Right. Max Aquatic.
Right. Seriously, Ace McCloud is the name of the guy that flies. Like, come on.
And then there was a guy that was like half cyborg, right? Like Strafer.
Right, that was the big villain of the show, wasn't it?
Strafer, I think. Yeah,
something he had like that.
Yeah, half of his body was a cyborg. Who's the green guy? The air, the flying guy?
No, the flying guy was light blue and gray. That was Ace McCloud. There was the guy that was like the ground guy, who I also had, but whose name eludes me. And then
he had
there was
a mustache, right? He was a green and black.
No, that's the underwater guy.
Max Ray.
Max Ray, there you go.
That's right. And I remember having this, and I asked for, or it came separately. You would attach it to the back of them, and it would actually work in the bathtub.
Yes,
water, the tidal blast thing.
I remember
that thing.
Yeah,
it was like orange, and you'd snap it on the back of him. And I love that he had that mustache.
Right,
convenient for a scuba mask. yeah, I don't remember the other guy. That was like Jake something.
Yes, you're right. You're exactly right. It's Jake something. That was their gimmick, you know. It was like, I'm the air guy, I'm the land guy, and I'm the water guy.
Yeah, something Jake Well or Jake Speakwell or
Jake Groundwell, you know.
Right.
Whatever the most obvious name to give the guy who goes on the ground.
Yeah. So I found a bunch of those. I thought that was funny that I found those, and then I found some old mask toys.
That's crazy because my mother just brought me a mask toy.
Really?
As well. Yeah. Do you remember the...
They might be in cahoots. Then maybe that's what's going on here.
Maybe. You might be onto something there. There was a drag racer that was... The toy's name was different in the cartoon from the box. It was like the Jetfire Skyfire dilemma from Transformers. It was either Firefly or Dragonfly. The toy was called one. In the cartoon, it was called another. But it was a drag racer. It was orange, driven by a guy named Julio Lopez, who was an outrageous Hispanic stereotype, if ever there was one.
Right.
And so, yeah, that was just recent. And that one was one of my very favorites. So that was just delivered. And it's like new. The condition, it's like it just came out of the box until my son got his hands on it.
Right.
It was like it just came out of the box. But it's great. Like, it's so much fun to see him enjoying it because, you know, those toys, the mask line was released in 1985. So it's, you know, it speaks to the...
Yeah,
the timelessness of those.
Well, who is the green helicopter mask?
Condor?
Condor, that's right.
Brad Turner is the name of the pilot.
Jake Rockwell, by the way, just came to me. Was the
Rockwell, thank you. Yes, Rockwell, Groundswell. Rockwell.
Right. And then there was like, there was a couple others.
I remember Max Waterpuddle.
Ace McCloud. Max
Jake
Ray.
Terra Firma.
Ray, you know, come on. But, yeah, so speaking of the Transformer stuff, I dug out some stuff, and I had found some Transformer stuff, and my son grabbed it, and, you know, he was playing with that as a car.
Snap it
right?
in half. Yep.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, I came home the one day, and some of my toys were scattered around the floor, and I was like, what? What's going on? I managed to keep these in good condition
sweat.
For years. All it took was my son an hour of playing before they're smashed and broken, you know. Mm-hmm. But there was one, it was a car, it was like a yellow car, and it wasn't...
Sunstreaker?
It might have been. Yeah, it might have been. So he was like, oh, this is a car. And then I started pulling him apart and he couldn't believe it. Like his eyes lit up. But I was thinking, the reason I bring that up is because you said how crappy the new toys look. Comparatively, I mean, it's like night and day. I mean, think about some of those early ones, right? I mean, you even had which was the ambulance? That was
Ratchet. Fantastic.
That toy was.
Ratchet and Ironhide. Which were the same mold, just painted different colors, right? Ironhide was red, and he was a van, and Ratchet was a white ambulance. You remember, their toy forms did not look anything like they did in the cartoon.
Right, right.
Like, they were totally different. And then there were other ones that were really faithful, like Hound and Mirage, Wheeljack, Jazz. Like, they looked just like they did in the cartoon. But every once and again, an Ironhide and Ratchet's like the perfect example of that. They look... You remember they were like little squirrely guys hiding behind windshields and like the back section was like a big boat that they sat in.
Right.
And I was like, whoa, what, how'd you go so wrong here? What went wrong?
And there was, what was the sort of hot rod racer? He looked like,
from the original, the original line, or later? What color was he?
Blue, and he looked
One from the original line. There was a red race car in the original line called Sideswipe. Like, he kind of went together with the yellow one, Sunstreaker. But then there was a blue Corvette that was like the second or third wave. He was called Trax.
Trax. I think that's the one that I had that broke, and I was so furious. I'd just gotten him.
He has a red face.
Yeah.
That's Trax. Yeah.
So
that was a really cool one. That blue Corvette was one of the coolest ones they ever made.
Yeah, so sad. Then I remember it broke. The arm broke on it.
Do you remember there were these two kind of crappy Transformers that I don't think they ever showed up on the cartoon? Like, they were part of the toy line, and you knew they were stupid because they never made it into the cartoon. Where they were also among the first ones that had those. You remember the holograms where you'd put your finger on the sticker to reveal if they were an Autobot or a Decepticon, right? They were, one of them was called Topspin, and the other one was called Twin Twist. And you would pull them back, you know, and they'd make a little clicking sound with their wheels, and then they would race forward, and they would pop, and they would stand up, transformed.
Right.
Except that it rarely worked.
Right.
Like, they would stand up, do 7 flips, and shatter into a million pieces. Or
now, did it have this thing you would pull? Do you remember, and I don't know, I'm trying to remember, these might have been different toys, where I don't know why that's ringing a bell to me, but it was like on a yellow sort of like pull stick.
No, that's something else you're thinking of.
But you know what I'm talking about, right? That like they go up. It's like almost like a zipper, like a half zipper,
like a
ripcord.
Are you talking about a ripcord?
Right. Yeah, and the toy sat at the top of it, and you sort of hold the base of the toy and yank your finger with this ring, this yellow ring, through it, through the base of the toy, and it was like a top almost, like you'd pull it back like a ripcord, and it would pop off.
Seems familiar, but
and it would zip around. If anyone knows what those are, please on Twitter
call Clayton. Here, I'll give you his number.
Grizzly Bear Cafe on Twitter. I would love to know what those are.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking about those two because I think they must have been inexpensive. Those two Transformers that they're supposed to flip and stand up. They had a name. You know, like that, those two, they had like a special name. Like, you know how like there were the Headmasters or the Dinobots? Like, these two things had a name. And I think they were fairly cheap because like there was that one year at Christmas where all of us, everyone we knew, all got them.
Right.
You know, they must have been like a dollar cheaper than the other Transformers. So we all got Topspin and Twin Twist. But you know, the fun of it was like when that, you know, when the regulations, whatever it was, the FCC changed its guidelines in the 80s and suddenly you could have cartoons that were nothing other than 30-minute commercials for toy lines. The fun of those toys, like He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, Mask, G.I. Joe, Transformers, Thundercats, etc., was that you wanted the toys that you had to be featured in the cartoon. Like, that's what you wanted.
Right.
And these two dudes, who were lame, never showed up in the cartoon. And that, like, somehow made them not real. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, they were fake Transformers because they never showed up in the cartoon.
They might as well have been those other toys that were, like, next to them or adjacent. Or you'd go to the supermarket.
Right, the generic knockoff.
Right.
Like Funbots!
Right. They were in the, like, they were, and they had that cheap bubble plastic on cardboard backing, you know, that you'd find. And your mom would be like, oh, they have Transformers here. You want to get one? You'd be like, Mom, those aren't Transformers.
Those are Funbots. Don't buy them.
And they would come with like a Jolly Rancher inside the box. Like, you knew that they weren't real. Do you remember
promotional consideration paid for by Jolly Rancher?
It was like some random like tie-in gimmick with some cereal that you knew that it was like it was not really Transformers. It was like Fantormers or something like that.
Right,
you know?
Right. Like the promotional text on the box had been translated from another language incorrectly.
Right.
Like, control the former, you robot.
Right. It's like one of those Asian nail boutiques, like Gorgeous Pretty Beauty Nail. Like, you know
number one Super King Buffet.
Oh.
I love your boneless spare ribs.
Do you recall, and I think it was one of the early comics that I ever had, was, and you, I don't know if you gave it to me.
I know what you're talking about. Go ahead.
And it's not the Kool-Aid Man, but it's the Transformers limited series. It was like a 4-issue limited series. Yep. Where one of the issues, and I remember it distinctly, I think it was like issue 3 or something like that, where it had the black costume Spider-Man,
yep,
wrapping around Megatron.
Yes.
Do you remember this?
Yes.
And I remember seeing that comic everywhere. Right. Like, even though I had it, I remember seeing it in, like, a bag.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
You know those, like, assortment packs that, again, you might get at the supermarket?
Like at Kmart.
Right, next to the area where the rubber ball on the paddle toy would sit. Like, it was always, like, a bag of comics. Like, and this was always one of them.
It was the, you're an afterthought birthday gift.
Right.
That's what that is. I'm just going to throw you right under the bus right now, Mike Cunder. That year that you came to my birthday party and you brought me that, the variety pack of comic books, was like the saddest thing ever. And in this variety pack of comic books was, of course, this is exactly why I know what you're talking about, Transformers Limited Series number 3 with the black Spider-Man costume from Secret Wars, an issue of Kull the Conqueror.
Right.
Kull the Conqueror. And Power Pack.
Oh, that was like in the, that. It was in that assortment pack, wasn't it?
Right. And, you know, so they put, of course, they put the one with, like, a Transformer and Spider-Man on the outside of the pack, because you could only usually see the one. And then you knew there were two other books in there, but the way it was packaged, you couldn't see what the other books were.
Right, because you didn't want to bend the spine to find out.
Right. Well, I mean, you would have had to literally open the packaging in the store, which as a kid, you know, you wouldn't dare to do that. And, so you just assume that they must all be cool. And then, of course, you're like, oh, my God, Kull the Conqueror. No, no one reads Kull the Conqueror. And then, like, even worse, you know, for a while then, do you remember when Marvel had that offshoot called Star Comics, where that's where Thundercats was? There was a Care Bears comic. If you remember the short-lived 80s group called the Popples.
Was My Little Pony a part of that as well?
Probably. Like, all that stuff that really wasn't firmly in the superhero genre was on this offshoot. You know, it might have been like a licensing agreement they had with a toy company to do this, an imprint called Star Comics. And after that went defunct, like, then those became the fillers in the variety packs. You know, there'd be that one, like, Spider-Man or X-Men book on the outside that you wanted.
Like, and Peter then, Porker, Spider-Ham was, I remember
oh
that being
oh my God,
there,
I forgot
right?
that even existed. Peter Porker, the Spectacular Spider-Ham.
I think I had a few of those because
I
of
totally
that.
Did. I totally had Peter Porker.
G.I. Joe was in there too, right?
Mm-hmm.
I do remember
right,
G.I.
Like all
Joe.
This, all the stuff that, you know, didn't do Spider-Man or X-Men level sales numbers ended up in those variety packs. Like, from that run of Avengers where the Avengers was like Dr. Druid, the Black Knight, Star Fox, and She-Hulk, those are all in there.
I'm even sure I had an Alf comic from Star Comics, if
yeah.
I'm not mistaken.
That was, I think that was like, I hate to say this, but I think that was the marquee title of the Star imprint. Was Alf. And then a couple years later, you know, that was sort of like 84, 85. After like 87, 88, you remember when Marvel did the New Universe? Then you'd get those variety packs, and the middle would have like Star Brand or DP7 or Night Mask or one of the other New Universe books that didn't even tie into Marvel continuity.
Right.
And you're like, why is this in here with, you know, Kull the Conqueror and Alf number 8?
Like, get me a Visionaries comic again.
I have issue 2 of the Visionaries, I'll have you know.
Really? I didn't realize there was more than one.
Yeah, I know I have issue 2. That was the only issue I had, was number 2. And I think it was a limited series, but it drove me nuts that I could only... Because I really liked the Visionaries. Like, of the C-list cartoons from that era, the Visionaries and the Sky Commanders were head and shoulders above everybody else.
Hmm. Yeah, Sky Commanders. That's another one I think was in that box also.
You did love your Sky Commanders, Mr. Morris.
I loved Sky Commanders.
You loved them.
Was that only one season, that cartoon?
Yes, I'm pretty sure it was.
Because I don't remember anything more than the one. I'll never forget going to Service Merchandise that afternoon on a rainy Saturday afternoon where my dad was like putting together a bookshelf, and I was sitting there watching Sky Commanders, and I just couldn't wait to get these toys. I would string them up between... And the cord was never long enough, right? Like,
no.
If
it,
you wanted
it was
to,
never strong enough. It was never long enough.
Yeah, and you wanted to like string it between like a curtain rod and maybe...
The telephone like a, pole outside.
Right, or like a doorknob across the room, and it was only like 3 feet. So yep. You'd have to, like, settle for holding it.
Right.
And that was not good enough.
Yeah, it could go from the towel rack to the toilet, if you were lucky.
Of course, a toy like that would never get made today, right? Because, like, a kid could, like, hang him or herself with
right.
it. Right,
exactly, yeah. Strangulation hazards and things right. like that. Which is amazing. I don't know anyone that was killed by a Sky Commander. I don't know anyone.
Me neither. Bring him back.
Then again, other than you and I don't know anyone that had a Sky Commander.
That's true. That is true. I think you and I were unique in that. And I think when we go to the toy aisle now, like, they're so the really crappy, because you've got like Spider-Man in 8 different costumes, like Arctic right. Spider-Man.
Right.
No yeah. joke. I mean, there was like an Arctic Batman and like an Arctic Spider-Man. Like, sure. when does Spider-Man ever need to go to the North Pole? And when he does, why does he need to wear a white costume?
Right.
Like, he's not worried about blending in New York.
They even poke fun at that in Batman the Brave and the Bold in that last episode where like they put him in one of the ridiculous action figure outfits for a scene, which I thought was great. But, yeah, you know, I tell you what, this is I know we're getting long in the tooth here, but this is something, I don't know if children today have something like this, but in the dying days of a very popular toy line from my childhood called the Superpowers line, somehow, like, the distribution of the final set of action figures was all mucked up. Like, all the normal stores that you would go to when we were kids to find these toys, like the service merchandise, which Clayton just mentioned, or like a KB toy store when those existed, you knew where to go to find the toys that you liked in these stores. But then every once and again, you know, as a line was dying out, or, you know, there was a hard-to-find figure, things like that, they weren't always where you thought they would be. And it became like a scavenger hunt. So sometimes you would get out your phone book when that was a relevant thing to do, and you'd call local toy stores looking for what you wanted, you know?
Right.
Like there was that one hard-to-find Decepticon jet, you know, like nobody had Ramjet. They had Thrust and Dirge, but no one had Ramjet. And you would call around to the toy stores, like, hey, do you have Ramjet? And, you know, and some poor schlep of an employee would fake like he went and looked, come back to the phone and tell you no. One day, a store at the end of the Berkshire Mall in our hometown of Reading, which I think at the time it was a Wanamaker's, is what it was going out of business. And they were having kind of like a clearance sale, and they even, to accommodate the throngs of people that were coming to take advantage of the savings, I don't know if you remember this, they even opened up the back rooms, like the storerooms the customers could walk into, which I had never, as a kid, I had never seen that before. This must have been at, like, whatever age I was finally able to ride my bike. And so I was blown away by the fact that I could walk into the back room of a store. And when I did, there was this pile of the last series of Superpowers figures, which I had never even set eyes on. I didn't know they existed. I didn't, because, you know, there wasn't like an internet. It wasn't like you Googled Wave 3 Superpowers figures and saw what came up. And right. there was Plastic Man, and there was Captain Marvel, there was Cyborg, there were all these figures that I didn't even know existed, but I didn't have enough money. The crazy thing about that, that day will stay with me to the day I die. Like, you discovered something new like that that you had no idea was anywhere in existence. And then by the time I did have the money and went back, the store had closed. Those figures, those three in particular now, Plastic Man, Captain Marvel, and Cyborg, you look them up online, those figures, mint in the box, are $300 action figures. And that they're the most valuable and most difficult to find of that entire series. And, like, that drives me nuts because I saw them. I knew where they were one day, and I missed my chance.
You know, I actually, maybe a few months ago, I was looking at some of the different lines, like the Toy Biz line, which was obviously like inspired by these early Superpowers collections. And the Superpowers collections, I think, were under Kenner, right?
Yes, you are correct.
And I don't know why, I was just playing around online and discovered like a really cool toy website where a guy had chronicled this and actually had the artwork for the fourth wave line.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I have seen that
you
as
have?
Well.
I know that, like, and I'm not sure all of the ones that I remember. I just remember certain ones like the Flash or Kid Flash. That were,
might have been Reverse Flash. Man Bat was one of them.
Yeah, Mix-a-Plick. Who else? Oh, you know, Kid Flash was in there, Reverse Flash, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, there was Batgirl.
Yes.
Two, and but they were never made, and I think I think there was even like up to like 6 or 7, like or 4, 5, and 6 or something like that, from what I remember when I was playing around online. Like there was a whole line that just never got made, but they had the artwork and the designs ready to go, even some vehicles ready to go.
Yes, and there were a couple prototypes, because when that website came into existence, I think part of what it was at an auction somewhere, some of the Wave 4 prototypes were sold to a collector. And that information got online, and then all of a sudden, it all started to come out. Like, that design artwork, what the plans were for the subsequent lines that got canceled. And, you know, a lot of them were, as crazy as this is, when you think about how gigantic the DC universe was, a lot of them were just characters Kenner made up. Like, they weren't real DC characters. Kenner just made up stupid characters of their own.
That's crazy. Because I remember reading through some of the people who were coming, and I'm like, I don't recognize these people.
Right. Like, I think half of that Wave 4 were just made-up Kenner creations.
Fascinating. And then, of course, like, the Super or the Secret Wars stuff came out, I think, like, a few years later.
Right, yeah. About a year, year and a half later, Secret Wars started to roll out.
And those were always lame. I mean, I think I had a lot of them, because I know you were a bigger fan of the Super Powers collection, because I think you just had more of the DC guys than I did.
Yeah.
I don't know that I had any. I think I may have just had Flash or something like that. But I had all the Secret Wars figures, and I was not a—I mean, I liked them just
because they weren't very articulated. You know what I mean? Like, the Superpowers had a lot of points of articulation, but Secret Wars didn't. You could move just at the shoulders and at the hips and turn their heads, and some of them you couldn't even turn the heads.
And they were even less durable. Like, you'd like rub the
chest,
like the art, like the paint of Spider-Man, right, and the paint would come right off.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. The day I got home with my Doctor Doom, who didn't have a cape for whatever reason, his chest, you know, the thing printed on his chest came right off on my thumb.
Right. Yeah. I had, like, Baron Zemo, I was even afraid to hold. He was really cool.
Zemo was cool.
I was afraid to even, like, touch him because, like, the paint was going to come off, so I didn't want to, like, play with him.
Yeah. Within the first week, I had the Dr. Octopus. There were the four villains in the original assortment, Dr. Doom and Magneto, neither of whom had their capes for whatever reason because they were cheap, Zemo and Dr. Octopus. And three of Dr. Octopus's four arms fell off in the first week that I had him.
Yeah. I think the same could be said. I think, you know, I remember I thought you had the Aquaman one, and he was kind of, like, deteriorated a little bit. Like, some of his, I don't know, his green pants came a little chipped or something. Hmm. Didn't you have the Lex Luthor, like, that green and purple, ridiculous-looking Lex Luthor?
I did, yeah, I had him as well. You know, I did have some Secret Wars. The one I always wished that I had was the Falcon, who's one of my favorites.
Right.
And I especially do now, because if you see what that line where that had the Falcon in it, Iceman, the Constrictor, Those are like the same. Those are like $300 figures if you have them now.
Wow. Impressive. Well, hey, speaking of getting rid of old things or not, or hanging on to them. In fact, the other day I went through and blew the dust off of some old PlayStation 2 games. And, you know, because I was putting up a new bookshelf in my basement and discovered, like, all these old PlayStation 2 games and everything. I'm like, you know, I just got to get rid of these things. I'm not going to play them. I beat some of these games, you know, even some old Xbox games. Like, I'm not going to play these again. I've already beaten them, right? Might as well actually get some cash for them. So I put them up on our friends over at Gazelle.com.
Right. Our friends and longtime show sponsors at Gazelle.com do exactly that. They take consumer electronic goods like video games, you know, whether it's for streaming media, GPS, you got a laptop, you got an MP3 player, DVD players, whatever kind of electronic good you have and aren't using, you can monetize by visiting Gazelle.com. You'll just tell them a couple things about the condition it's in. They'll make you an offer, which stays good for 30 days while you contemplate whether or not you can part with your beloved consumer electronic good. And then you print out the free shipping label that they'll send you in an email. Off it goes. They'll evaluate it, and they'll send you money. Put it in your PayPal, cut you a paper check. They give you an Amazon.com gift card. You can even donate it to charity through Gazelle.com if you're so inclined. Man, it is so easy. Even I've been able to do it, and I've done it a number of times. We really like these people. We would not endorse them on the program if we hadn't used them personally and successfully, I'd like to point out. We like Gazelle.com, and so will you. When you're checking out from their website, please make sure to indicate you heard about them from us, Grizzly Productions, because we want them to continue to like us. And when great companies like Gazelle.com and our friends at Cobra Electronics continue to support us, we're able to provide this and other great Grizzly Productions productions to you, in my redundancy.
Indeed. We thank them so much for their support of this show, able to pay for the bandwidth on the show and storage and that sort of stuff. So thanks. We're able to do this a little bit here and there. So
that's right. Now, I want to take a second and let you know, since sometimes we forget to mention this, there are some places that you could come and see me. I'd love for you to come out and see me if you wanted to.
Yeah, what are you up to these days? You have any shows coming up?
I do. Thank you for asking.
Can I go see you?
You can come see me at Chikara. That is the professional wrestling organization that I call home. This weekend we're in our hometown of Reading, Pennsylvania, on Saturday night, February 25th. Sunday, February 26th, we have an afternoon matinee at the NYWC Sportatorium on Long Island, New York. And prior to the event in Reading, I believe around 1:30 in the afternoon, I will be at the Reading Public Library to discuss some of the history, traditions, and cultural impact of Mexican Lucha Libre. And some of my masked compatriots from Chikara will be joining me for this discussion. It is for families. It will be specifically geared toward young children. So if you have some young children interested in that type of thing, this program being put on by our friends at the Reading Public Library is completely free. So you're welcome to join us for that, and then come over in the evening over at the Goodwill Beneficial Hall and see us do our thing in the ring. Next month, I'll be in the greater Toronto area. I'm also coming to Canada's capital of Ottawa for the very first time. And then I'll be just about everywhere in the month of April. You can catch me in Rahway, New Jersey. I'll be performing in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I will also be in Chicago, Illinois, and then Lafayette, Indiana, just for starters. I'm also on some podcasts. One's called Daddy on Board that publishes every Friday. Come see me over there. And I sit in with Natalie Morris on The Trending Show, which publishes every Sunday, to get you all caught up on what's hot in the interwebs. Now, if our great fans, Clayton, want to see your smiling face on live television, to which band should they tune?
Tune it to the Fox News Channel, and you can always watch me there every weekend, Saturday and Sunday, 6 a.m. Eastern time to 10 a.m. You can find me there. Also, I've been doing some really interesting new tech segments every week. You can catch those online as well, called Tech Take. So I run down some interesting or new gadgets that I'm playing with, testing. Recently I got a chance to, I was learning about the website Pinterest that my wife is obsessed with. A new social network that actually had more traffic referrals than Google+, LinkedIn, and YouTube combined in the month of January of this year. It's one of the hottest growing websites. Really, really neat way to, like, you know, you sort of like have like a, it's like having your own like sort of personal cork board, like where you can put things up, things you want to work on, maybe things, projects around the house, recipes, books you want to read. People share those different things, and it's actually really cool. So anyway, I did a piece on that a few weeks ago.
Sounds fake. Sort of stuff.
I know it does, doesn't it? You got to check it out. So anyway, check me out over there, and also doing some good stuff on radio too for Fox Radio. Some interesting tech pieces there. So, and coming up pretty soon, I'll be covering the new iPad 3 launch out in San Francisco in the early part of March. I should be out there covering that. So I'll bring you all the details about what to expect from the new iPad 3.
And when does that hit the streets?
Well, we know the announcement's going to be March 7th, pretty sure. And so because it's the way that Apple works is they try to not have a lot of old stock sitting in their warehouses of iPad 2s. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. They're going to be selling the iPad 2 for a discounted price now, while the new iPad 3 will probably launch like a week or so later. Week and a half after the announcement, I would think. So they don't like to usually have like a long lead time. They don't want people like not, you know, like, oh, well, if I know the iPad 3 is coming, I'm just not going to buy the iPad 2 now. So there'll be like a lull. So they usually do it for like a week and a half later. So I'd imagine probably sometime in the middle of March, I would think. So that should be exciting. So there you go. That's going to do it for the show. Anything else on the docket?
No, I think we covered all the bases. So until next time, kids, we'll see you around the podcasting fire.
See you, man.